First, I want to talk about the table measurements. So last exercise that you did, I wasn't there for any of it, but I hope that you realize that real data is, well, troublesome at least. And there were two ways of doing it. Either you could just say, look, I am gonna try to cut away all those bad measurements. And at some point, I can't argue that view anymore. So for the rest, I'll take a mean and a standard deviation and an uncertainty on the mean. And well, then came into, if I understand what went wrong for those measuring, should I then correct it or not? And next, you could take the uncertainty that people came with into account and well, check if it worked. The other way was simply to make a fit of the data. And well, then you have to account for all the different variations people have. So it's not a simple thing. Whatever you choose to do, however you choose to do it, I'd love you to submit your results on the link that is given. And again, I stress the fact that I'm not going to point out anybody singly. I just would like to see what results you managed to get and how many managed to get questions. That's about it. Then let's jump to, well, we haven't had any heroes of statistics lately. So I thought that I would just quickly jump to the next one, which I think is Gauss. It has the name, the normal distribution has the name, the Gaussian. And well, there's a reason for that. Not that he invented it, but he was the first to sort of make the proof behind it. And for that reason, he was, a renowned character. And well, he's marked on the 10 mark bill before Germany, of course, became the a Euro country, one of the central ones. And his arithmetics is his magnum opus. It's written when he was 21 years old, but only published 3 years later. And he contributed to all sorts of parts of mathematics. What I like about it, and what you may relate to, is the arrival late at lectures, because Gauss did so as well. He knew that he was very good at mathematics, so he was inscribed at the university, and legend has it that he shows up late for the first lecture, and in fact, the lecture is over. So he says, all right, but at least he can see the homework is written up there. There are 10 problems written up. And he just copies them down, no cell phones at the time, and goes home to work on these problems. And they are exceedingly hard. He doesn't have a clue on any of them. And he says, that can't be true. So he doesn't show up the week after. And only after 2 weeks does he show up. And he has most of a solution for one of them and two ideas for two others. And seven, he's blank. He doesn't even really understand the questions, all of them. It turns out that in the first lecture, the math teacher had written up the 10 biggest problem in mathematics at the time. So there was a reason why he didn't really just solve all of them. And but that also goes to show his genius. He did solve some of the great parts of mathematics. And yes, he was arguably the first to have the least squares principle put into statistics. So that's his contribution. Today, we'll talk about transformations, or rather, how can you make random numbers according to whatever distribution you would like? And there are two ways, and I'll go through that. So let's jump to today's lectures, which is generally on what's called the Monte Carlo technique. And what is meant by that is just the using random numbers for solving problems, I would say. Random numbers have been around, but how you produce them is, there's a reason for that we have random number generators. Because anyone who considers arithmetic methods for producing random digits is, of course, in a state of sin, said by John von Neumann, who's one of the sort of fathers of the Monte Carlo technique. How do one define it? Well, I would say there's no textbook definition, but here's an attempt. So using random numbers to solve problems, typically without known analytic solutions and or of high dimensionality. And I'll come back to why high dimensionality has a point here. But for example, let's say you wanted to calculate pi. There are smart ways of doing that, but let's assume, well, let's say it's me who wants to calculate. I'm not that smart, but I have a fast computer. For that reason, I will simply say, well, I'll draw a unit square and I'll throw random points in it by selecting a random X and a random Y. And then I will ask what fraction of these hit inside and then multiply that number by 4 and I'll get an estimate of pi. And here it is. So that's a way of solving it. You might argue, okay, but that's only going to improve with the square root of n. And that's right. And that's not the smartest in this case. But hey, that's what I've chosen to do here. And in general, you can do that. So here you find the minimum and maximum in x and y. So you sort of corner the problem. And then you generate uniform random numbers according to x and y. And you accept x if it's below, if the y value is below the function, and you reject it if it's above. So you accept the red ones and you reject the blue ones. And now you've produced x values according to the PDF by this function. So it's a general method. Now, this was a special case of, well, calculating pi. But in general, what the challenge is, how do you go from uniform random numbers to some arbitrary distribution? And as I said, there are two ways. Let's start with the most formal and central way. The problem being, it doesn't always work. So we have uniform random numbers u, and we want x according to some PDF. How do we do that? Well, from the drawing here, imagine that we can pick a number u, and then we can go, there's a functional expression of u, which takes us from u down to x, and x is according to the distribution we want. So can you apply a function to u that somehow magically gives you x? Well, if x was a distribution here, then this would happen exactly when the function is the inverse of the cumulative distribution of x. Yeah. Why? Well, that's when the PDF of x is high, then the slope is high. And where the slope is high, the probability of hitting in that region gets high in proportion to it. And since it's a PDF, then the cumulative distribution, so the integral function, is simply a function from 0 to 1. So this is going to work, but it only works if you can integrate the PDF and then invert it. And as you all know, that doesn't happen always. Integration doesn't always give an analytic expression, and inverting doesn't always give an analytic expression. And this is why the method doesn't always apply. You can, of course, do it numerically. For example, let's say that X was distributed according to a histogram. Well, can you integrate that? Well, you can, and it's going to be a sort of step function type going up. And well, you can use that. Can you invert it? Well, not with a functional expression, but in code and in a numerical way, you can. You can also approximate just the inversion function if need be. So the use cases are rare, but it covers an example point or an important point, sorry. Namely, what if you want to, say, generate numbers, for example, exponentially distributed numbers? Well, what's the PDF? Well, it's an exponential function that's normalized. What's the range of X? Well, the range is 0 to infinity. Whoa, infinity, that didn't sound like a good range. Is that a problem? No, it's not a problem at all. So this method can produce numbers even if the range is not sort of limited. So let's just go through what's the recipe for doing it. Well, first of all, you have to ensure that the PDF is normalized. Otherwise, things are going to go to hell. And then you integrate F to get capital F of X, and you use this definite integral. So it's from minus infinity and up to the value X of F of X prime dx prime. That gives you this function. Now, notice the limits, because if you do not have the right limits on this, things are going to go horribly wrong. So in the case of the exponential function, you would say it's an integral from minus infinity, but from minus infinity to zero, the integral is zero. Okay, I'll take it from zero to X. But maybe you have a function that starts at one or something else. You have to consider this definite integral and remember the limits. And in today's exercises, I will say 2/3 of problems arise from not starting from this integral with the right limits. All right, then let's say we have F. Cool, we invert F. Well, that's not always easy, but let's assume, for example, with the exponential, that it can be done. Well, the inverse is just the logarithm. Fine, there you have it. You can generate exponential numbers by taking a uniform number between 0 and 1 and take the logarithm of it. And then it turns out to be minus the logarithm. And if the exponential has an exponent away from 1, well, you need to take that into account. But it all drops out of using this method. Okay. Here's an example with the exponential where that, you know, exponent it has been put in. Is it normalized? Yes. All right. We integrate. What do we find? We find 1 minus this. So now we want to invert it. Can it be inverted? Yes, it can. It comes out to be this. All right. So if we produce numbers p between 0 and 1, well, producing 1 minus p of p, that doesn't really matter. And then we take the log of it, and then we take negative of it and divide by lambda. And lo and behold, there you have it. And it's not a problem that's not bounded upwards in x. So that was the example. What do you then do when you cannot integrate it and invert it? Well, then you go to the accept reject method. Let me just get the chat up so that I can see questions at some point, at least. The accept reject method works when you can bound the place, the function, the PDF in both X and Y, which means it would not work for the exponential. And we call it the accept reject method. It's also called the hidden miss. It has many various names, but you pick X and Y uniformly in this range. So X here, whichever bounds it, and Y here, whichever bounds it. And then you ask if the point you picked is above or below F of X, the PDF. And if it's below, then you accept X. Notice you accept X, not Y. Y is just to help you to determine if you should accept the X value or not. And what is happening here is that when the PDF is large, the probability of being accepted is high, as it should be in proportion to. And when it's low, well, then it's more likely that X will be rejected. Now, the advantage of this method is its simplicity, because You don't need to integrate and you don't need to invert. You can just do this. And well, with modern computers, well, there's a saying that fast computers breed lazy programmers, which is to some extent true. Not that necessarily you're lazy, but maybe you're also smart, saying the time it's going to take me to solve this integral and whatnot, if it can be solved at all, is long. Let me just box it and throw it here. And it could be argued, look, if you have an exponential function, I know it goes out to infinity, but I'm just going to take a box, which is one high and 1,000 lifetimes long. And yes, it's going to be a slow algorithm because it's going to reject most points, but hey, it's going to work. And I got a fast computer. That is really ugly. And maybe you're running your simulation to test what happens when you get high values, and then you might miss the extreme. But yes, it would work. And let's just take an example of this, which is this. So 1 plus sine of x divided by 2 pi. So this is shown here. Can we find the integral of it? Yes, we can. So that works fine. X minus cosine of x divided by 2 pi. But can we find the inverse of this? No. It contains both x and cosine of x, and that doesn't, well, that we're not enabled to make a function that says x equals and then you know, switch things around. So the transformation method does not work. How about the accept reject? Well, is it bounded in x? Yes, it is, 0 to 2 pi, and that's even easy. Is it bounded in y? Yes, there's a maximum here, we can find that. And then, well, I'll generate points and select the x values of all the blue points, because those are the accepted ones, whereas the red ones are the rejected ones. And the x values of the blue points is going to follow exactly the random numbers from this distribution, f of x equals 1 plus sine of x, normalized with 2 pi. All right. Questions, please write them. I'm going to start from an end. So Jakob asks, the weighted average, can you put a few comments on when we use the inverse weighted average versus a simple weighted average? Yes, I would say always use the simple weighted average. I cannot think of a single time in the past 20 years that I've used this, that I've used the inverse weighted average. So you simply assign a weight, the formula I wrote, and the weight is 1/σ². You know, if you have twice as small an error, you should weigh 4 times as heavy. The typical 1/√ law. Marta asks, yeah, okay, never mind. Jamie asks, f of x mark is the function for an arbitrary value of x. Well, it's because x is in the limit, so you have to call the x inside of f something different, just another variable here, x prime. It's because you want to end out with the x. And both methods have identical application, and I'll return to today's exercises in a moment, because we will start by looking at problems which have the same, well, where you can do it both ways, and they have the same solution, hopefully. So, but there are some where one will not work, and there are some where the other will not work. And that triggers me, to say, sometimes neither will work. Imagine you have a PDF which involves both a PDF that goes out to infinity, which means you can't box it, so the accept reject method doesn't work, and you can't integrate and invert it. What can you do then? And the answer is, you think of a smart box, I would call it. For example, if the PDF has an exponential in it, Well, you would be able to use the transformation method for making exponentially distributed numbers. And then on top of those, you can apply the accept reject if the function is below those numbers. So you can use one method to make a smart box, and then you can use the accept reject method to select below those. Yeah. Raoul asks, what do we do for functions with high dimensionality when we don't know the boundaries? Well, if you don't know the boundaries, you're lost. And in general, it's very hard in high dimensionality. Making numbers in high dimensionality is hard, especially if they're correlated. If they're not correlated, well, then at least you can do it one dimension at a time. Maybe you don't know, maybe you know the PDF, and then you can do it from that. And the accept reject method will work nicely with that. The transformation method only works for one dimension. And now it might be that some smart mathematician said, I have a solution for several dimensions, but I don't have it right here. And if you don't know the boundaries, then you're lost. Nothing to do there. But then I'd say you have a very, very complicated problem that you can't just solve. Where do our uniform random numbers come from? Lasse asks. Great question. This is what the computer provides. Almost all random number generators are built from random numbers between 0 and 1. And they have been for the past 50 years. So this is where they come from. And then you might say, yeah, yeah, but where do they really come from? Because you said to begin with, don't produce random numbers with arithmetic methods. I'll come back to that later in the course. Where do random numbers actually come from and what is put into them? There is a little background into that. And yes, it involves the NSA in the United States. Why can't we use the in the current slide accept reject method example? Yes. Why can't we use the inverse if? Well, that's because we can't compute the inverse. There's no analytic way of inverting capital F of X. That is why. If we had that, then that would be fine. If you numerically invert it, that's also fine. But then I'd say, it's still that type of method, but you can always integrate numerically and invert numerically. So numerically, you can always use the transformation method, but here you can't. And there was a reply to Lasse, and Peter asks, these methods seem to rely on uniformly distributed numbers to generate random numbers from. Is this the case for all methods? Yes, is the answer. This is what we rely on. And Bia says, if you have a problem with high dimension, maybe works to reduce the dimensionality first and then work on reduced data. Yep, that's always a step. Maybe it's not simple to reduce the dimensionality. And Marcus, you're welcome to ask a question verbally. I'll crank up the volume. Please go.
Yeah. So about the table measurements, there are clearly a handful of measurements that are very good, and there are a whole bunch of measurements that stem from some kind of systematical error. And I'm not sure, we have Chauvenet's theorem to eliminate the points that are super far away, but some points or some data points that are clearly wrong, but are not bad enough to throw away using Chauvenet's theorem. How can we get rid of those without introducing our own bias?
Good question, Marcus. Thank you. Well, first of all, you can't. Well, you have one option, though. In Chauvenet's criterion, you're allowed to ask, where do I set the cut? At what probability do I accept points? So let's say a point is far away. It's 10 sigma away. Then you would say the probability of such a point is 1 in, 100 billion. but I do have 300 measurements or 500 or 600. So, okay, it's only one in a billion, but one in a billion, man, you're out. Next. But at some point, this number gets down to 5% or something like 1%. And there you have to set the threshold of where you cut things out. But this is why I would say you really have to look at all the points you exclude and say, I feel certain about doing that. There's also the 30 centimeter cut, if you want to call it that. People sometimes missed a ruler, sometimes had an extra in. And for that, you have to think, should I throw them away or should I correct them? What should I be doing here? It's not easy. So yeah. And what about a measurement which is, let's say, 10 centimeters away? Marcus, is that a bad measurement?
Yeah. I mean, it is? I would say so. You would have to like move the ruler like more than a centimeter each time you move it. So
yeah, but
it's very unprecise.
Quoted, but if the person quoted plus minus 5 centimeters or 10, yeah, plus minus 10 centimeters.
Yeah, then it just doesn't say that much about the length of the table.
No, but you know, who are you to? Well, this depends on what it depends on. What is a typical precision? And I think in this case that a typical precision is around, you may find your own number, 2 to 3 centimeters. Right? The core measurements make a roughly Gaussian distribution of 2 to 3 centimeters width. And by that, you might say, look, this was not very well done. But then 10 centimeters, well, if you take sigma to be 2 centimeters, then it's 5 sigma away, then you would say you're out. If it's 3 centimeters, then, well, it's dancing on the edge. Agree, Marcus?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So that's a good way of saying, look, at least 2/3 were able to measure it reasonably well within, you know, a Gaussian that follows this. And by that requirement, I'm going to throw away everything that's beyond some value.
So make the Gaussian like thinner. So we exclude the points that aren't like from the natural like broadening.
Yeah, exactly. And by that argument, you can say those are plus minus 30 centimeters. They're out, right? No matter if you take 2 or 3 centimeters.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me then just finalize today's lecture, which goes about dimensionality. Because in low dimensionality, say 1D, if you want to do an integral, there are smart ways with splines and so on. And that's by far the best solution. You could, of course, do it with random numbers, but maybe it's not that, well, it takes longer. Why? Because the Monte Carlo method only improves like 1/√(n). But in high dimensionality, the integral with smart methods, trapezoidal rules, and so on, only improves like 1/(n^2)/(2)/(dimension). And so when you reach dimensionality, a four-dimensional problem, it's actually faster to just say, to hell with it, everything, I'm just going to solve this numerically by using random numbers. It's smarter. So if you have a high dimensionality problem, using the Monte Carlo method is typically better. And the cut is at dimensionality 4. Then you might say, well, we typically live in 3 dimensions, but sometimes the Monte Carlo method is slower but faster to implement. So yeah, that's why. So it's a great tool. And I can say as a tool, I work on the ATLAS experiment at CERN, where we have a huge detector and a lot of data. And we're looking for rare events of that. What do we do to even understand the data? Well, we simulate it, and we simulate things to an itty-gritty detail. And there's been examples of, in this huge detector, or the likes, that there used to be screws in the detector, and those were made of a different material, but to begin with, the simulation didn't contain that. And then people changed the screws to be of another material, and you can see the tiny differences because we have so much data. So it's really simulated to a high degree. And that's because the dimensionality of the problem is, you know, extremely large. You'd never be able to sort of integrate your way through. It's impossible. So we do it by simulation. And by simulation, we actually get sort of copies of the type of collisions of protons that we look for. And now we can say, all right, based on those, what's the efficiency? What if we do this? What if we do that? So the method is used to an extreme degree. And I hope we'll touch upon it regularly for the rest of this course. And I'll hope you sort of pick it up by saying, yeah, that's easy to make things according to my distribution for my problem. Let me test it. All right. And Lasse asks, those expressions are for computer time. Yes, it's for computer time or for generating each number or taking a step in a trapezoidal rule. So it's more each step, but that is typically computing time. And then finally, just a little history. You might not know this guy. His name is Stanislav Ulam. And he worked out in Utah's desert on the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb. And he was ill, and he was sitting in his little hut and could do nothing but play solitaire. And then he started calculating, can I calculate how often solitaire should, you know, should be successful? And you can imagine, well, the dimensionality grows fast because, well, three cards, what can you do? He was a really smart guy, but he said, you know, this gets overly complex. How about just doing it, say, 100 times and counting how many times it works? And then at least I have some estimate of the success rate. And then he told that story to John von Neumann, and they began to use it for actual calculations in reality of how to build, well, not only the first atomic bomb, but actually the much more powerful hydrogen bomb. And Stanislav Ulam is, you could say the co-inventor of the hydrogen bomb with Edward Teller. Teller being the more sort of renowned person behind it. To some extent, Stanislav Ulam is the father and Teller is the mother, because Stanislav came with the idea of how to ignite a hydrogen bomb. He laid the seed, but otherwise he didn't do much. It was Teller that nursed the idea and brought it up and built the whole thing and made the project, well, work. And hopefully in our lifetime, the same process of fusing hydrogen is what's going to give us non-CO2 energy for many millennia to come. All right, that's it for lecture. And finally, I want to talk about today's exercise, which is an exercise which I could actually find here, especially if I had not worked on something else. But here we are. If you go to transformation, accept, reject, and the one called simple. Well, let me again share with you. So here we have it. Can you all see the screen? Well, complain in the chat if you can't. And we run it. And what is it doing? Well, it's considering the function, a linear function here. Now we want to generate random numbers according to this distribution, which is 2x from 0 to 1. 2x is normalized. Well, that's great. Can we get the integral of 2x? Well, that's x squared. Can we invert it? Well, yes, that is square root of x. And so there we have it. Do we get this distribution if we take square root of x of the numbers that we get out? Well, apparently so, shown here. So here we just say by transformation, we take the square, we integrate and make the inverse, and then we apply it. And out comes numbers according to this distribution. So there you have it. That was the transformation method. What about the hidden miss, the accept reject method? Does that work here? Well, 2x is in the interval 0 to 1, and in y, it's in the interval 0 to 2, so that should be easy. So here, as a loop, we just loop until we have enough accepted values. And when we have that, we ask ourselves, does that give the distribution? And it does. And here I also calculate the accept efficiency, namely how many points do you have to throw in order to get n points? And here the efficiency is not surprisingly 50%. Why? Well, that's because you throw in a box like that and you get half of them out. That was to be expected. There are a few questions below, and we also fit it just to see, you know, does it work? And don't look too much at the questions here, but there are two other problems. There's one where now it's not 2x, but it's x cubed. So a third degree polynomial, a simple one that can be inverted, but nevertheless, you have to do it from 0 to z, meaning it's not normalized. You have to find z in order for it to be normalized. First, solve the problem from 0 to z, and then solve it again from 1 to z. And if it doesn't work, then I assure you, almost assure you, that it's the limits in the integrals that you have to take into account. Okay? Now, regarding efficiency, Jamie asked, can't you just let it run overnight? Yes, fast computers, you know, and 50% efficiency is not a problem. In higher dimensionality problems, you could run into cases where the efficiency is perhaps 1 in 1,000,000. And then it might be heavy if you need 1,000,000 points. But yeah, normally efficiency is not really a problem. And finally, Jen is asking if we can find the answers to last week's exercises in the course web pages. No, I've actually not posted them there. I've only posted them on Git. So you can go to Git and find the solutions there. Appstat 20, week 1, example solutions. And here they are for week 1. And I can imagine that obviously the question is for week 2. And they are coming, hopefully, later today. All right. Any other questions? And finally, I can say there's a third degree polynomial, and then there's the one called general, which is just three problems, which you can try yourself if you can make the method work. So, and if you are in doubt, then the ability to solve problem 3 in the problem set is probably related to today's exercise. And then Miriam says, can we see our answers to the table measurement exercise? No, I will go through the table measurement exercise in one of the lectures next week. I want you to have a chance to submit answers first. Cool.
Just quick question about next week. We will be meeting at 9 o'clock.
I will write out about that. I have to review how much I have to talk about, but it's not unlikely.
Okay, fine. That's all.
Cool. And Sarah asks, can you recommend an article for applications of using the Monte Carlo or accept reject method? Well, in the course webpage, there are actually quite a few comments quite a few notes. I would say Glenn Cohen's book, chapter 3, which he actually sent me a long time ago. I've posted it here. The Wikipedia entries are probably your best bet at an explanation for their use, Sarah. And then something called the Particle Data Group, write notes on Monte Carlo generators. And you will note who wrote that. Well, one of the world leading experts on generation, which is Glenn Cohen. So that's just an extension of chapter 3. But chapter 3 for Glenn Cohen, I think, is 4 pages or max 6. So it's maybe worthwhile to use. So Hjalte comes with one application, but there are really, really many. It has become what I would call a ubiquitous method. Ubiquitous method. It's used everywhere.
Tools?
Yes.
So about simulations, how do you think people simulate molecular interactions with materials?
Well, not all things can be solved in this way. Typically, you have to have a PDF for the problem, which you might not have if what you have is a model. So it does not apply to everywhere. And also, I should say, each field has its own tricks and tricks of the trade. And so it doesn't enter everywhere, but it's entering more and more and more in all fields. And I think on that happy note, I will stop sharing. And then I think we should just meet for the exercises. Remember to take a look exactly where they take place. And then I look forward to seeing all of you either on Zoom for the exercises or in person. See you later.